You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hi everyone, I'm Hillary Kerr, the co-founder and chief content officer of Who What Wear, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today on the podcast, I'm speaking with the founder and CEO of Hello 7, Rachel Rogers. Rachel's mission is to teach women, especially women of color and other marginalized communities, how to succeed financially in spite of the very real obstacles they face. Through her company, Hello 7, she gives women tangible steps and coursework on how to make and retain more money without sacrificing their sanity in the process. Via her podcast and online club, Rachel also reaches over 50,000 women a week, further empowering her community to change the systemic cycle of overworking and under-earning. Now, on May 4th, she'll also add author to her resume with her first book, We Should All Be Millionaires, A Woman's Guide to Earning More, Building Wealth, and Gaining Economic Power. But before she was a business coach, CEO, and self-made millionaire, Rachel actually got her start working in the New Jersey Superior Court and even started her own law firm at the age of 28. As you can imagine, Rachel has so much wisdom to impart, and I can't wait for her to take us through it all. Now, on Second Life, it's Rachel Rogers. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so excited to sit down with you. And I'd like to start at the beginning. What did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
I planned to be a lawyer right from the very beginning. My mom used to watch crime dramas and like legal dramas on TV all the time. And there was inevitably always a lawyer like standing up for the little guy. And I was like, I want to be that lawyer. I want to stand up for the little guy. And so, yeah, I had planned to go to law school from 8 years old. And wow. I actually did it.
I mean, that's amazing. So what did you study in school? Because I feel like there are lots of different paths to law school. And I'm always so curious about that.
Yeah. So I studied political science. It's almost like the, I don't know, it's the typical major when you want to, when you know you want to go to law school. And I was really obsessed with psychology in college as well and took a lot of classes, you know, whatever I could find on that. I also took every class that had the word women in it. So it was like women in leadership, women in history, women in society. I mean, there was every class that had women in it. I took that. I took psych classes. And then I don't even remember the political science ones, if I'm being totally honest.
So you were a legislative intern for Senator Hillary Clinton, where you served as the assistant to her deputy, chief of staff, legislative director, and legal counsel. So how did you land that internship? And what in the world was it like? I can't tell you how cool that sounds.
I actually landed it because I was going to school studying political science and learned about this semester in Washington program that they had at my school, and I applied for it. And you could apply and go and work for a representative or a senator in DC, or you could even find other organizations that were in DC and intern. And so, you know, my parents have always been Democrats. They always felt very passionate about voting. And so I always went with them every year to vote and started voting as soon as I could. And so I was really interested in it. And of course, I chose Hillary, which I thought it's probably a long shot getting that internship, but I got it. So I went down for a semester, lived in DC for about 4 months under this internship. And her legislative counsel at the time was a Black woman. And I was working in the most senior office outside of her chief of staff. And it was a hot mess, which I find fascinating. You know, like it was like files everywhere. It was very disorganized. Everybody is just like, you know, because the office gets kind of thrown together when you get elected. And this was early on. She was still a brand new senator. And so it was just a hot mess up in there. But the legislative council would bring me into all of these meetings. Like, you know, there's always meetings going on behind closed doors. The Russell Senate office building is just like a series of rooms, right? And so the senator's office is spread out from like these two hallways, right? And so sometimes I'd be like whisked into this room and I'm sitting there and like Senator Clinton is there and she's meeting with a trade group or any other kind of group. And I could tell she'd like dart her eyes at me and I could tell I was not supposed to be there. But I feel like, you know, the legislative council in particular, but basically everybody there, they wanted the interns to learn. So it was amazing. I was shocked that government is as messy as it is, but they still get it done. They sure do.
So what were you learning in that internship in terms of skills and in regards to the career that you saw for yourself?
I feel like it was a reality check. Honestly, it was like almost more that than career skills. I think the career skills that I learned were how to be useful, right? Mm-hmm. Like get yourself into the right room. Yes, it's important, right? So like find a way to take things off people's plates, find a way to get things done nicely, you know, and neatly for people, right? And so that they want to keep calling on you, you know, whatever they asked me to do, I would jump in and do it. And I think that was a skill that I learned. People were very, very busy. I mean, the mailroom alone was insane. If I got that amount of mail, I think you'd need a staff. Like we had a whole intern pool that was just opening mail and processing mail. But each of the legislative staffers who were like on environment, on, you know, just different topics, they each had like their own little mailbox, right? Or I shouldn't say little. It was fairly big and it was always overflowing, like papers falling out of it. And that's exactly what it was like to talk to them. Like they were all so overwhelmed. I don't know how they did it. Some of them had kids. I was like, how did you have kids? You're always here, you know? So it was insane. I was in rooms where probably very important things were talked about that I had no business in there. I learned how to spot a politician. It's like you can spot, you know, when you are seeing a politician in the hallway versus a staffer, they could be dressed exactly the same and they just have an energy about them.
Okay. I feel like that's a good skill to have. So you also were a legal assistant at a lobbying and public affairs firm. What does that mean exactly? For someone like me who is a civilian, I don't have any idea what kind of work that entails. And I was hoping that maybe you could clarify some of that for me or illuminate it.
Yes, yes. At lobbying firms, you know, what they're doing is representing large companies. Like one of our clients at Podesta Mattoon was Philip Morris, right? And so there's legislation being passed around, you know, something related to regulation of cigarettes or something like that, or growing tobacco. And so the lobbyists are there to call their friends that work in all the senators and representatives' offices and convince them either to pass this or not to pass this, depending on what Philip Morris wanted, right? And so it's all relationship based. And that is the key thing to understand about DC. It's every single person, like not just the politicians, but their whole staff, they're all connected and they've got friends in other offices. And so they are all constantly, it's like one big, endless, complex negotiation that is constantly going on. And so that's really what they were doing. They'd be meeting with people, they'd be doing presentations, and they'd be also fighting to get something that their client wants shoved into a bill that has nothing to do with the thing that their client wants, right? So like, that's basically how it works. And they would also come in and deal with PR crises that a company was having and those kinds of things as well. So that's essentially what they did at the lobbying firm. And Podesta Mattoon was interesting in that they were Democrats and Republicans, right? So it was both parties represented within the firm. And so, you know, the companies that were their clients, they had interests sometimes on both sides. And really it was just like, what can we wiggle into getting passed as a law because it's good for our company or it's good for our trade association?
Wow. Oh, that feels Byzantine.
Yeah, it's really disappointing when you're like a bright-eyed, like, you know, thinking you want to work in government, and you get there and you're like, oh, this is kind of sleazy, maybe, you know? I mean, not everybody, right, is sleazy, right. But it particularly at a lobbying firm, it feels pretty icky. I don't think that I fit in that well there. I remember my boss, who was like the VP of the firm, she was very important. She would never tell me when she was upset with me. She would just basically passively aggressively like bang things around her desk.
Oh, that's great. That's leadership.
Exactly. And I'd be like, just tell me, I want to do better. And then she'd send someone else, like somebody who's not my boss, who I don't work for every day, to come along and tell me what I need to improve and how like I'm failing. I remember one time I got in a lot of trouble because I went to the Hill to do some research that they needed for a presentation they were working on. And I got in trouble because I ordered them lunch before, and like all the lobbyists were in the like war room, right? Like in the conference room working on some like PR crisis or something that a client was experiencing. And I had another project that they had given me a task for. So I'm like, okay, well, while you're doing that and don't need me, I'm going to go do this other thing. So I ordered lunch for them. And apparently the receptionist went out for lunch shortly after that. And they had to go downstairs and get the pizza themselves. And it was
the horror.
The horror. I mean, I got so like hardcore chewed out for that, that I wasn't standing there to receive the pizza.
Oh, my Lord. That tells you everything you need to know. Thank you for painting a very accurate and clear picture of that situation. So I also want to talk about the fact that you went to undergrad and then immediately went into law school. Some people take time off. You did not. Was that always the plan? And did that much school, because that's a lot of school, did that much school back to back seem daunting to you?
Yeah, I mean, the plan was always to go to law school at some point. I thought about, you know, studying some of the other master's programs that people who worked on the Hill, because when I worked for Hillary, the people who were the legislative staffers, that's the job that I wanted. And so I was like, okay, maybe I should do one of these like masters in public affairs or one of these kinds of programs. And so I really explored everything in my like junior and senior year of college. And after doing all that, I eventually came back to going to law school. And again, the reason was money. A sister is very focused on her dollars. So I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to go to law school because I feel like I have a better chance of earning a solid income. And I could always use that to get a job in government if I wanted to as well. Right. It seemed like the more versatile degree. And also, you know, after exploring so many different options, I just sort of came back to that dream and that vision. And I just decided to stick with the plan.
So after law school, you took a clerkship working in the New Jersey Superior Court. What in the world does that job entail? And what were you learning? Because I like to think that it's going to be very sexy, but I feel like the reality is perhaps not. But either way, I'd love to hear about it.
Well, here's what's interesting. I was placed in family court. So I worked for a judge who was, you know, overseeing divorces, sadly, children being taken from their homes because of parents who were not fit to parent at the time, just all kinds of family scenarios. And I learned a lot of skills at that job. The judge that I worked for was amazing, just an absolute great guy. He gave me so much opportunity to learn. And so basically, I was essentially a voyeur into all these people's home life because, you know, they'd be filing motions and, you know, we got hundreds of motions filed every week. And so I would read them first and create a summary and then give the summary to the judge so that he, you know, basically making his workload smaller. And so that was my job, was just to turn through all these motions. And some of these people became like repeat characters because they were in the process of getting divorced and they were in the court all the time because they couldn't make a single decision without fighting over it in front of a judge. And so they'd file these motions and you'd read a motion from, you know, the husband and you're like, oh my gosh, this woman, she's horrible. And then you read the other side from the other spouse and you're like, actually, no, he was horrible. He was the horrible one, right? And so what you learn after doing that all day, every day is that both parties are embellishing and lying a little bit. And you start to really be able to discover what is the middle ground? What are the commonalities between the two stories. I feel like, honestly, my bullshit detector got really, really honed during that time where I could be like, nope, this is nonsense. This is nonsense. This is the real story that we need to decide on. Okay, great. And I could put that in front of the judge.
I mean, that is a wonderful, very highly applicable life skill to have.
Absolutely. The other thing that I learned there that was incredibly valuable is mediation and negotiation. And I had studied mediation and negotiation during law school, but really getting to do it. So here's what would happen. Every Friday, just think about the things that divorcing parents who are co-parenting, what are they going to fight about every single holiday? They're like fighting who gets the kid and for how long and blah, blah, blah. Can they meet the new girlfriend or not or whatever? It was always lots and lots of drama. I mean, I feel for people going through a divorce. It is the worst time in their lives. And that's when I was meeting all of these people, right? But every single Friday, and particularly if it was a holiday, someone would file an order to show cause, which means that it's an emergent motion that has to go before the judge immediately. And really, the reasons that they are there is for actual emergencies, like, you know, this child is being taken to some unsafe place and they need a judge to give permission to go collect the child and get the, you know, sheriff to help them do that, right? Or something like that. But instead it's used for, I'm supposed to have July 4th. They're trying to take July 4th. They didn't bring the child back on time. I want to fight about it. You know, I'm filing a motion and I want the judge to like take away all their holidays or something really unnecessary, right? And so they would do this every Friday, which meant that we would have to work late and we'd be like hearing this order to show cause because we have to do it before we leave for the weekend. So I became really good at, I would call the person and say, tell me what's going on, what happened? And they would tell me the whole story and I'd be like, yeah, yeah, they shouldn't have done that. Yes, I totally understand, and be very empathetic with them. Mm-hmm. And then I'd be like, okay, let me call the other side and see what I can do. Then I would call the other parent and I would say, yes, I know they're terrible. I know, but what if we did this? Would that be a good solution? So I tried to work it out among them. My judge used to walk by me on Fridays, just laughing hysterically. Cause I'm like, I'm trying to save my weekend and his, you know, and it worked. And I'm telling you, so many orders to show cause got resolved because I got on the phone with both parties and in 10 minutes was like solving the drama. You know, I think they just needed to vent and have and be heard. You know what I mean?
Don't we all? That's an interesting point, though. It's like really hearing people is an incredibly important skill to have because, you know, whether you are in a court or in a one-on-one meeting with someone who reports to you, like if someone feels seen and heard, that just diffuses things no matter what.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is what they teach you in mediation as well. So it was cool to be able to learn that skill, hone that skill, and I definitely have used it many times.
I'm sure. So after a year, when you were only 28, you took a major leap and opened your own law practice. Tell me about coming to that decision. That feels very young. What made you decide to do it? What was your thought process like?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it was young. My thought process was I had spent that year because clerkships are only for a year, right? You come in, you do it for a year, and then you get kicked out because the next clerk is coming. Occasionally, you can get a second year out of it, but often no. So I knew that I only had a year to find another job. And so I was going to all these networking things, meeting all of these heads of different law firms and, you know, in the area, especially the ones that were coming in front of my judge. And I had the referral of my judge, which was super helpful. And so I just started, I applied for government positions. I mean, you name it. And I got several offers. And when I assessed all of those offers, just none of them really lit me up. I was just like, I didn't go through 3 years of law school, spend six figures in loans, right, to do a job that I don't feel passionate about. So I was like, you know what? Screw it. I think I'm just going to do my own thing. And I started researching creating your own practice. And what does that look like? And what do you need to do? And I mean, I was so nervous, but it's what I wanted. So I was like, okay, I'm going to take the leap. My judge was like, you're going to do what now? You know? My mom also was like, why aren't you taking these jobs? And this was also in the middle of a recession. So, you know, right. I graduated in 2009, right after like the 2008 recession was underway.
Oh, fun.
So, Yeah. So the jobs that were available, I mean, there were good jobs, you know, but they didn't pay as much as I want. And we've already learned that I'm very yes. motivated by money. So I was just kind of like, if I'm going to be broke, I might as well just be broke now. Like, keep being broke. It's easier to get, you know, used to starting your own practice and continuing to struggle if you've basically been a poor college student for 7 years and you can just add an eighth year to that, right? Instead of taking a job out of a firm.
That is a good way of looking at it.
Exactly. And that's what led me to the decision to start my own practice.
I love that. So there are obviously a million types of law. You were mainly practicing IP law, correct?
Yes. Business law and IP. Because of that recession, right? I wasn't the only one starting my own business. I had lots of friends who were getting laid off from their corporate jobs and getting severance packages, and they were using those severance packages to start their own businesses. And so I was like, okay, this is my niche. Like, my first couple of clients came from, you know, my circle of family and friends, and they were all starting their own businesses, and I was doing the contracts for them and some of the other transactional work. And then, you know, like, they also, these businesses, in addition to forming a business, drafting contracts, et cetera, they were also creating IP that they needed to protect. And so I started doing that. It was a need in the marketplace. I could fill it. It was interesting to me. And so that's how I got into it.
So what were your biggest challenges during those early years? And what came a little bit more easily?
Oh my God, so many challenges. I think what came easily, within the first year, I was getting all of this media attention. I learned how to get press. And so that was helpful in getting clients. I also discovered that I was really good at selling and marketing my services. Basically, I was just teaching. I was educating people on starting a business, the legal steps that you need to take, what you're responsible for as a business owner. And so that education piece, I was good at that. And then that brought in lots of clients. So getting clients, which is for some people is really challenging, was not that hard for me. What was really hard was doing the work. That's what was hard. Meeting all of the deadlines and just juggling all of the different legal work that I was doing. I'm not somebody who has really strong execution strengths. I'm great in front of a crowd or talking to people. But when I have to sit down and draft contracts, it was always left to the last minute. And mind you, I did good work. I did quality work, but I was always stressed out about it. So that was the challenging part. And then, of course, I started hiring other attorneys and started building the practice and managing other people. Ooh, that was a whole education I had to get.
We talk about that on this podcast all the time. It is so hard. And mm-hmm. I also think there's something to, like you, I started a business at a young age. I hadn't been managed a lot. So then to become a manager when you don't necessarily haven't been managed yourself and don't really know the ins and outs of it is hugely challenging.
Yes, exactly. So I made lots of mistakes with employees and as a manager, letting people get away with nonsense, not treating people the way that I should have, like expecting them to, you know, work insane hours or just do too much. You know, I made every single mistake and I'm glad I made them because then I could learn from them. And luckily, some of those first employees are still, you know, contacts of mine. I send clients to them. They send clients to me. Like, we're still friends. And I'm so grateful for that. And they tell me, like, they learned so much from me. And I'm like, well, thank God, because I feel like I did a really poor job.
We're also very hard on ourselves as women. So there's some of that going on too. So yes. 3 years in, you also started Small Business Bodyguard. So can you walk me through that concept and what you learned through creating that resource?
Yes. So I was an IP lawyer, right? I was protecting other people's intellectual property and seeing how they could make money from that IP. And so I was like, a sister needs to make her own IP and make some money from that, especially because I was so busy, you know, delivering all of this work. Like I said, I was good at selling. And so I would sell, all of these services and then have the hard work of delivering it all on time by myself often. And so that was really hard. And the other thing I saw was a market opportunity because there were a lot of people who were young people too, who were starting businesses, but they really couldn't afford my services. And I was like, well, I can't work for peanuts. And so I was like, I wonder if I could create a resource for them that would give them some of these tools and some of these templates and things like that. And so I decided to do that. So Small Business Bodyguard, you know, and there was LegalZoom existed back then, right? LegalZoom was becoming really big at the time, and then other competitors were cropping up. But I felt like they really fell short because it was software, but it didn't really explain what was going on to the entrepreneur. So they were making these decisions and creating these documents, but they didn't really understand what was the content around it, right? Not just like, what does this clause mean, but like how to think about their business and the legal aspects of their business in general. And so I wanted to teach them that. So Small Business Bodyguard is essentially like a 300-page book in which I also include contract templates and instructions for creating a business entity and registering your copyrights and all of those different things that people had been asking me for all the time but didn't want to pay for my services. So I created that, packaged it up at a reasonable price, and sold a real lot of it. Like, it wound up becoming 40% of my total revenue each year.
Wow.
So it wound up being a really great thing to do. Exactly. It took so much work. I was creating it while I was pregnant, and then I had my baby early and still had to finish it because I had already launched, like told people it was coming.
Oh my Lord.
It was a tough summer. Let's just put it that way. But I got it done. And our initial launch, we made $80,000 from that. And that was the most I had ever made at one time. Like, that's an annual salary, $80,000.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was, I was like, wow, I'm really onto something here. I was really thrilled. It taught me a lot.
So you also had your law firm for 7 years. I'm curious about how it evolved over time. So obviously it started out just you. You grew the team, but did your scope of work change? How did your day-to-day change over that time?
So yes, I mean, you know, I remember 1 year I had an attorney, an operations manager, and a second part-time attorney. And that was the team, right? And then, like, you know, occasional help to help with like web design stuff or things like that. It was a really small team. And I remember we did like an annual review. I got this great idea, like, let's get together for 2 days and just look at our numbers from this year and see what are our opportunities, right? And so we did that, right? We went to like some hotel lobby and like sipped cappuccinos and ordered appetizers and looked at all of our numbers. And what we discovered is that the majority of our services revenue was coming from one service. And so I was like, oh my God, all the money comes from one thing. And there's all this other stuff takes up so much time. It's so much work. And we actually don't need to do it. We could just do this one thing. And so we streamlined and decided to focus just on trademarks because it was really easy to systematize, you know, create a real clear process around it. And then we just were churning out trademarks and selling them like hotcakes. So that's one of the things that I learned, was like really honing in and focusing on one area or one main offer so that you can scale it. It is so much easier to scale a business when you have one offer instead of like 17, you know?
Yeah.
And each one of those offers has to be marketed, sold, delivered, right? It is a lot to do for a very small team. And so that was probably one of the biggest takeaways that I had. And as soon as I did that, our revenue shot up significantly.
So let's go back to the managing piece of it. For anyone who's listening to this podcast who has a team or is thinking about growing their team, what advice would you give someone? What do you know now that you wish you'd known then?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I learned is that I don't have execution strengths. Like, I'm not really good at working a to-do list. You know, I can sell, I can market, I can speak publicly, I can teach, I can create intellectual property. There's a lot of things that I can do. The follow-through is not my strong suit. Systems and processes aren't. So I think if you can figure out what you are really good at and figure out how to, you know, focus your marketing and even the delivery of your service around something you're really good at, and then fill in the gaps by hiring a team and letting them work in their strengths, right? Like, if their strengths are working a spreadsheet, great. Like, that matches really well. I think in the beginning, I was trying to hire more of me because that's what I was comfortable with. So then you just wind up with a bunch of people, none of whom can actually get the work done consistently. You know what I mean?
I do think that's a classic thing that people do, especially with some of their early hires, is tend to hire themselves because that's what they're familiar with. And like you, I think that once you realize, like, no, I actually need someone who has a complementary skill set, not my exact skill set, that cracks open a whole new world.
Absolutely. The other thing I will say, too, that I've learned about running a team and managing is the over communicate. Like when you think you're communicating, the other person is probably still not getting it. You know, I think we can say it once and then we can just move on. Nope, you got to say it at least 80 times, also write it down, also put a deadline on it, you know, also create a checklist around it, right? Like you have to do so much more communicating than you think is necessary to actually work as a team and get things done. And I think that's something that's really missed. If you can make it crystal clear so that like no one could be possibly be confused, that's the level of communication you're looking for when you're working with a team.
So true. So let's talk about Hello7, which is your business coaching and membership service committed to helping women, non-binary, Black, and other marginalized communities make and retain more money, which is the best. I'm always curious about when an idea comes to light and then the time between getting that idea and then actually making the change or making the leap. So how long had you been thinking about the concept of Hello7?
Yeah. You know, what's interesting, not long, because I'm a quick start. So I have an idea. And that, I mean, this was the problem with managing my team, right? I'd have a new idea and be like, let's do this thing. And they're like, we're still working on the last thing. So yeah, I had that idea. Mainly what happened was I was building my law practice. I got it to between 500,000 and a million. So not quite up to a million yet, but close. And a lot of my clients who were women entrepreneurs were coming to me and saying, how are you doing this? Like, how is your practice so successful? How do you get clients? What are you doing? And so I would be coaching them and teaching them what I do to grow my business. And then I realized, I should probably be charging for this. And so I started dabbling and I just took on one one-on-one client and charged them for it. And then I took on another, and then I did a small group, and I just was dabbling with coaching other business owners while still delivering legal services and managing my law practice team. And I realized, oh, this is way more fun, you know, than like hitting deadlines and getting legal work done. And I was also like, it was that 7-year itch. I had been practicing law for 7 years. I was starting to get bored. I felt like getting wins for clients wasn't that complicated. And I needed something new, you know? And of course, you get good at something and then you're like, let's start something else that we are not good at and figure it out.
So walk me through the nuts and bolts of dissolving the law practice and starting Hello7. Did you end up keeping some of those clients? Were you doing outreach for new clients? Tell me how this all shook down.
Oh my God, it was real messy.
like Senator Clinton mailroom messy?
Exactly. There's a saying that the law is a jealous mistress, and that's exactly what I experienced. It's like this, it's really hard to leave the practice of law because you have cases that take years. I mean, I had a case that just got resolved at the end of last year, 2020, and I had closed my practice at least 4 years before. Some cases don't just wrap up nice and neatly. Sometimes they get real caught up in the government of it all or other things that cause delays. And so you can't just be like, and we're closed, goodbye. You cannot do that. You literally cannot. And also, good luck trying to get another lawyer to do the work, you know, that is like the tail end of some long, boring case. So it was real messy. I started coaching and, you know, I got advice actually from another entrepreneur who had transitioned. And I give this advice all the time now around transitioning from one thing to the other, which is that sometimes you just have to wind down one while you rev up the other and just allow it to take time. When we're done, we want to be done, but it doesn't always work that way. And so I probably practiced law for at least another 2 years, just like with only a handful of clients. I kept a part-time lawyer still working with me. And between me and him, we were just trying to like clean up and get done all of the remaining stuff. It's not like there was work every day. It's like it's 6 months before you hear anything on this particular case. And then it's a bunch of work over a couple of weeks and then you're done. And then after a while, the part-time lawyer was over it. So he left and I was like, come on, now I got to do all this. It was a real bummer. But yeah, there was a time where I was like, listen, I don't want to hold on to this anymore. So I'd actually rather either pay another lawyer to do this work from scratch or whatever. So we just figure things out. I talk to clients. I mean, the one thing that I'm great at is mediating, negotiating. I talk to clients and said, look, here's a lawyer that can do a better job with this. Here's what's going on for me. Here's how I'm going to make this right for you. And I was always good at, you know, making it right for the client so that they get the end result that they want, that it doesn't cost them any additional money, et cetera. So there was a lot of negotiation and messiness. And in the meantime, the coaching totally took off. I was so excited about it. So I was doing VIP days and one-on-one coaching, group coaching. I did a bunch of retreats. I had every kind of coaching offer you could think of and wore myself out. Ooh, I was tired. Mm.
But in that first year of business, you hit $1 million in revenue, which is crazy impressive. I have to ask, how? Like, how did you
yes.
do that?
Well, I mean, the good thing was, right, that I had a reputation as an attorney. I was already trusted. There was overlap in the audience that I was talking to. So it's not like I had to go find this client. I already knew where to find them and was always good at selling and marketing. So I was good at getting myself in front of them and telling them what I could help them do. And a lot of those early clients had amazing results. You know, they were making like $100,000 a year and like working way too much for how much they were making. And of course, they were taking home less than that. And I'd work with them and then they'd get to $500,000 or they'd get to $1 million, right? Like they'd make significant, and not everybody got to $1 million, not everybody got to $500,000, but a lot of them did. And so those success stories went around, people were seeing them be successful and they were like, hey, who's your coach? And that's kind of how that happened. So I just wound up getting more and more clients interested. And it was a lot of fun. I loved it. And I think part of the reason why we were able to hit those numbers was, number one, right, same audience. So I already had an established audience, which I did not have when I started my law practice. And the other thing too is like I had learned so much about running a business. I learned about how to market yourself. I had learned that lesson of like have one offer. So a lot of those lessons I had learned already as an entrepreneur, and now I was able to actually do what I love and am passionate about. So it's almost like it goes faster if you're doing something you really want to be doing versus when you're doing something that you're like, this is okay, I can do this, it's good money, but it's not what you're passionate about.
I very much agree. We all know that historically in the US, talking about money has been somewhat taboo, especially for women. I'd love it if you could talk about the reasons it's important to have these open conversations, because I try and talk about it on this podcast. Sometimes that goes well. Sometimes people don't want to. I try and practice what I preach, but it's hard.
Yeah, it is. And you know what you're doing, right? Like when you talk about money, especially as a woman, as a marginalized person, you are challenging society, right? You're challenging the messages that we are taught in society. And that's not easy, right? It's not necessarily popular. And trust me, I get hate mail. People message me and they're like, stop talking about how rich you are. And I'm like, I don't even think I talk about how rich I am. I talk about how you should get wealthy, right? Like, but I don't, but I'm like, but you know what? My response to that was to get a necklace that says rich bitch. And I have it on right now. And it just helps me own it, right? Because the real truth is that there's this message that we are all getting, this subliminal message in a lot of different forms of media that women should get smaller, stop buying lattes, stop buying shoes, stop being a shopaholic, cut coupons, save every dime, right? Make do with less is the message for women. And for men, if you look at the same money messages, right, what are said to men? Oh, you know, take risks, invest, like,
takes money to make money.
Yes, exactly. It's like all of these empowering messages around you can do it, go make money. And for women, it's like, honey, like you need to rein it in. And I think that's nonsense. Women, there's actually studies that show that women are better investors, that when VCs back women-owned businesses, they are more likely to get a return on those yep. businesses. There's all kinds of stats that show women are actually excellent with money. And so I'm here to just normalize having money, and you don't have to be a celebrity to make a good amount of money, and that you can talk about it. And if we don't talk about it and share how we did it, you know, how we're managing our money, what are we investing in? If we're not sharing those resources like men so clearly do, right? How are we going to help other women make it happen?
Yes. So on that note too, let's talk about the center of Hello 7, which is We Should All Be Millionaires, the club. Can you walk me through some of those core offerings and how you put it together from a coursework perspective?
Yes. Well, honestly, we launched with the minimum viable product, right? We put it together and really focused on the things that we think women need and people need in order to grow successful businesses and build wealth and turn their business into a really viable, profitable asset. And so that includes you need education, right? You need business training on things that you don't know about, like building a team or, you know, creating offers, marketing, sales, all of those things, creating systems. So we know that they need education. They also need coaching because sometimes you know exactly what to do, but you're not doing it because you're scared, right? Or there's some other limiting belief going on in your head. And so coaching is an important piece of that. And then we also offer community because there are incredible stats that show that when you put yourself in community with other folks who are trying to accomplish the same thing, you are like 95% more likely to accomplish it just by being surrounded by other people who are on the same path. And so that's what we wanted to provide. And we initially populated it with some of those programs, like Small Business Bodyguard is one of the programs that's in there that teaches the legal side of it. There's programs in there that teach them how to go from 100K to a million, how to, you know, deal with some of that mindset stuff and how to create boundaries and some of those like softer, like interpersonal skills that really affect your personal life, which affects your ability to build a business, you know? And so those are some of the programs that are in there. And then over the last year, we have been developing something we call the Hello 7 Growth Scale, which I'm so excited about. And we've just started rolling out this new program to our clients, but it really is a path from 0 to 3 million. And it shows you what are the steps to take at every level. So at Hello 1, what are you experiencing? What do you need to focus on? What are the mindset issues you're running into? What are your biggest challenges and how do you solve them? And then at Hello 2, which is 25 to 50K, what do you need to do there? When you get to that $250,000 to $500,000 mark, what are the action steps you need to do there? So we're really showing the exact step-by-step path from 0 to 3 million, because that's what I wanted. So it took a lot of time to get this intellectual property out of my brain, and is all validated by IRS data and Census Bureau data and the Amex Women in Business report that they put out every year, so that it's not just something I made up or it's not just based on my experience. It's based on actual data showing what challenges women have at every level of business. And I think it's important because then you can focus on the challenge that you are having right now. Sometimes we have shiny object syndrome as entrepreneurs, and we get very distracted. Oh, our friend's over there doing this thing. I need to do that. Or, oh, my other friend is doing this. I need to do that. No. You need to stay in your lane, focus on the problem that you need to solve at this level, right? Mm-hmm. And then solve that problem, grow your revenue as a result, and then move on to the next level.
So in addition to all of this, you have also created the Anti-Racist Small Business Pledge, which has already had over 2,500 signups. That is impressive also. Can you explain it for anyone who might not be familiar?
Yeah. Well, last year in the wake of George Floyd's murder, I was just outraged, right? Like we all are. And it's almost like, here's the thing. Black people live in this country with just a general rage happening all the time that we just learn to live with and cope with. And there are moments where you have flare-ups, right? And other days you just do your best to keep moving. And I think that just for some reason that incident in particular just brought it to a head. And one of my friends says, you know, for her, Trayvon Martin, that's what radicalized her. So what happened with George Floyd radicalized me. And I was just ready to do something about it. And I wound up doing a video just because I needed to talk to other small business owners who were in my industry who were doing things like saying, oh, this is so terrible. The end. You know what I mean? And I was just like, yeah, no. Mm-mm. You know, one of the things that was happening is, you know, another business owner who has a large community, a lot of the Black women in that community were kind of spilling out of the community and talking about how they were being told not to bring this up in the community. You know, like, this is, we're here to talk about business. Don't bring this up. And if you don't think racism affects Black people's ability to grow and sustain a business, then you're bugging, you know? And so I just was so upset seeing them talk about it. I just decided to share what I was thinking. And I went live on my Facebook, my personal profile, just to the people who were friends of mine or whatever. Well, they all started sharing it and it went viral. Not that I was expecting that, because trust me, I would have did my hair. I would have put a bra on. I would have made some different choices if I knew it was going to go viral. And as a result, right, like, I was calling out different entrepreneurs and saying, like, hey, you need to step your game up. And really, actually, you know, if you're going to collect money from Black customers, then actually give a crap about what's happening to us in this country. And I didn't want to leave it at that, right? Like, all these people online were talking about me calling folks out. And I was like, I don't want to just call them out. I want to call them in. I want them to actually join this fight against racism, not to just tell them they did it wrong. You know, like, that, I don't, what do we gain from that? Nothing. And so that's why I decided to host a town hall. And along with my friend Erica Hines, who is a DEI expert, create the Anti-Racist Small Business Pledge to give people a starting point to say, you know, I'm all about action. I don't want to just talk about it. People were acting like they were so confused. And I was like, let me give you some steps. Let me give you, like, your starter kit. Here's the things you need to start with, right? To start becoming anti-racist, not just someone who doesn't feel you're a racist.
So we also have to talk about your book, which is coming out on May 4th, and it's called We Should All Be Millionaires, A Woman's Guide to Earning More, Building Wealth, and Gaining Economic Power. So, you know.
Small things.
Yeah, small things. So why did you want to write this book, and what has the process been like for you? And I'm curious if you've had anything unexpected happen along the way.
I think I wanted to write this book because I feel like we as women need to focus on our money. We need to turn towards our money. And so much of us, like, you know, we think of every other way to serve and to share, and we give so much of ourselves. But I think a huge piece of gaining more seats, right, in Congress as women, and seeing more women judges and having equal pay, a big part of that is building wealth, right? Like, being able to donate in big ways to those political campaigns for the people that you want to represent you, you know, being able to fund causes that matter to you. I feel like making money is this sort of overlooked thing, or, you know, we're all just kind of making enough, having a good enough career and calling it a day. And a lot of people just focusing on, like, the six-figure salary is like the end all be all. And I'm like, I don't know if y'all have noticed, but it's really not that much money. You know, 100K is not that much, especially today, right? I mean, just childcare alone will obliterate that. All right.
Yeah.
So I wanted women to be focusing on building, you know, seven-figure net worth. And I wanted to teach them exactly how to do it, not to just say, oh, this is some pipeline dream. No, you can do this. And, you know, one of the things that I said to, you know, in my book proposal when I was pitching this book is that I am the person to write this book because I did not grow up wealthy. I grew up low income. I did not marry a wealthy man. There was nothing in my background that slated me for becoming a millionaire. I had, like, a 400 credit score, you know, in my young adult years. I was, like, a negative net worth because of all my law school loans. Like, my money situation was not good. And I wanted to show people my story so they could see you could go from that. You could go from a negative six-figure net worth and a terrible credit score to, you know, a millionaire and to owning millions in assets. And I wanted to show them the exact pathway to do that.
So what I really love about the content that you create is not only is it inspiring, but it's also very instructive and very actionable. For instance, in the book, you talk about the steps to live like a millionaire and how to get out of mental money jail. Can you walk us through this concept for our listeners?
Yes. I mean, I think it's so important that we are actually taking action to shift our thoughts. So it's really about thought work, right? It's really about, you know, we believe that we're not good with money because of the messages from society. And because, you know, we couldn't have credit cards until the 70s. We couldn't get a bank account without a male cosigner. We couldn't get loans. you know, until very recently. And so all of that messaging is still very strong with us. And it's important to start shifting that thinking. And so, you know, in that chapter, I'm teaching a quick and dirty guide to thought work and how to start shifting your beliefs, right? And changing the tracks that are playing in your head. Because a lot of us talk to ourselves, right? And we talk to ourselves very poorly.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm such an idiot. Oh, I did the wrong thing. Oh, I'll never figure this out. Oh, why? Who am I kidding? Who do I think I am, right? And we just play it. And it's almost like, you know, like a trail through a forest. It just like creates this trail that is just constantly followed. It's a bad habit. And so what we need to do is create new neural pathways, new trails in our mind with positive thoughts and with thoughts that, yes, we can do it. Yes, we are good with money. Yes, we are able to accomplish those things. And so it's really just about, you know, that's what I start with. Whenever I work with clients, I always start with, what are the tracks that are playing in your head? What is the story you are telling yourself about your ability to earn money? And let's create a new story. Because if you don't fix it in your mindset first, if you don't start to see it for yourself, you're never going to take the action. I could give you all the action steps. You're not going to do them, you know?
So if readers could take one thing from the book, one thing, what would it be?
It would be make million-dollar decisions, not broke-ass decisions.
Oh, I'm feeling inspired by this already. I also want to talk about the reality that women have really been going through it in terms of the workforce. Of the 1.1 million workers who left the workforce in September of 2020, 80% of them were women. I think 100% were women in December, something horrific like that.
Mm-hmm.
What is your advice to women who are unemployed at the moment and desperately trying to get back into the workforce?
Yes, this is a serious issue and something that I feel so passionate about. And here's my advice. My advice would be take stock of your earning potential. I think sometimes we just have to get creative. If there's not a job or an opportunity out there for you, then you need to create one, right? You still have, even if you don't have, if you can't find a job with a company, you still have skills that you can sell. And so I would encourage them to take stock of their skills. Like, you know, if you were a salesperson at your previous role, could you be a salesperson for hire? There are so many small businesses that do not know how to sell or struggle to just get through all the sales calls. Could you become a salesperson for a company and pitch yourself, right? There are, you know, any number of skills. Like if you're an amazing baker or you make beautiful jewelry or you have consulting skills, like how can you start to sell those services and find someone who is interested in the problem that you can solve with your skill set? I think having entrepreneurial skills and being able to earn an income without a job is the ultimate job security, right? It doesn't mean that we're all meant to run our own businesses, because let me tell you something, it is a lot of work. So I don't blame anyone who doesn't want to do that. However, it is definitely an excellent gap filler should you find yourself out of work and are struggling to find another position. You can sell the skills that you have. So I would encourage them to take stock. What jobs have you had in the past? What needs are you seeing among your neighbors? Sometimes we just have to be creative and do it ourselves, frankly. I mean, how many times do women have to just do it ourselves? Like all the time. It's story of our lives.
Constantly? Yeah. I feel like that is the through line in our stories as a whole. So yes. I think it's also important to really talk about how some of the skills that we learn in our first life have direct application to the stuff that we do in our second life, even if it might not seem the case on the surface. So I'm wondering, what from your first life in law do you still use today?
Yes. So many. I mean, for sure, communication, like when I was learning how to solve problems and deal with challenges working for the judge and dealing with, you know, warring parties and getting them to agree on something. I mean, this is something that's very useful in your team when people are disagreeing on things. One thing that law school definitely taught me was how to write. You have to write so many legal briefs and you're taught to be very concise, but also keep it interesting. Also, you know, weave a story from the facts that have happened. And so that skill set has definitely helped me in writing my book. Also, public speaking skills I learned in law school, because when you're representing clients, you got to speak up in court and even in mediations. And so the speaking skills also came from practicing law. So honestly, I don't think that I could be the professional that I am today without that first life, right? And that first career, it taught me so much. And those skills are so transferable to what I'm doing now.
So, Rachel, we also like to talk about mistakes on this podcast because everyone makes them, but all we show is our highlight reel on Instagram. And that is true, but not the whole truth. So I'm hoping you can tell me about a mistake that you've made in your career and what you've learned from it.
Oh, yes. I have many. Probably the most disruptive and most expensive mistake that I can think of right in this moment is when I was creating Small Business Bodyguard, that resource that I created when I was practicing law, I decided to partner with another entrepreneur who had a lot of copywriting skills and, you know, had a bigger audience than me. I knew I could create this product. I thought she was probably a better writer than me. I also thought, you know, she's already got an audience. I don't know if anyone will listen to me or be interested if I don't have someone partnering with it who's already in front of a bunch of people. And so I just had imposter syndrome and partnered with someone who I didn't know well. I only knew her for probably less than 6 months. And as you can imagine, you know, the problem started at the outset, right? Like as soon as we started creating this product, I was seeing signs that she wasn't showing up. She wasn't delivering. She was always too busy to like do her part. And so finally, I got tired of doing all of the work, but still sending her 50% of the profits every month. And so I said, let's have a conversation about this. And I thought we would, you know, my negotiating and mediating skills, I thought for sure we would talk, we'd work it out, we'd come to some agreement about what did she want to do, what didn't she want to do. We could adjust the shares or whatever and just figure it out. No, I'd had one conversation with her. And the next thing that happened is she had a lawyer call me who was very aggressive and very nasty. And yeah, that started a 3-year lawsuit in federal court over that piece of intellectual property. And I was super stressed out because I was also, I was representing myself for a little while. Then I got a friend from law school, but I could barely like afford all of those fees on top of running my business. It was a very challenging, very painful time. It was like this sore that I was carrying on my body for 3 years. And it just took up so much mental space. And it finally got resolved 3 years later. And I think the lesson learned there is like, wow, I am enough. I was enough. I did not need to partner with anybody. I did not need help to sell this thing or create this thing. I had all the skills I thought I didn't have. And that imposter syndrome cost me a lot of money. So I think it's important for us to recognize we got the skills, right? We are capable and we probably are more capable and more skilled than we can even imagine. So don't walk around with imposter syndrome. Ask for more money, negotiate, don't partner, right? Keep all the profits for yourself is the lesson.
You have everything you need. It's all there. It's hard to internalize. I mean, it is.
It really is.
There's a lot to learn from that. So I also like to think about advice on this podcast, specifically for everyone who listens, who is interested in switching lanes or embarking on a new beginning in their own career. What advice would you give someone?
I would say find a way to dabble. Like find a way to get in there and just try it. Because, right, you don't want to necessarily give up a career or give up what you're doing if you're not sure. You think it's going to be a certain way and maybe it's not that way, right? Like get out there and try it. First of all, it'll be fun and exciting and satisfying, especially if you're bored in your current career. It'll be something fun to do and just create a little side hustle out of it. See if there's a way for you to try this thing that you're thinking about doing. You'll just learn things and you'll be reignited and you'll create a better pathway, I think. I think sometimes you would think, I'm such an action-oriented person, you'd think I'd just like jump off a cliff and say, I quit. You know, but I had kids to feed, right? Like I was the main breadwinner. I could not quit if I wanted to. So I had to transition. And I think that was the best thing ever. So I don't want you to have a 2-3 year transition necessarily, but definitely just get out there and start doing it in some form or another is my recommendation.
So my last question is my favorite question, which is if you could go back in time and speak with younger Rachel and give her some career advice, what would you say?
I would tell her you are enough. That's what I would tell her. You are enough. live that, embody that in everything that you do. You've got this. That's what I would give her a pep talk, because that's really all she needed. She had everything she needed. She just didn't know it, you know? So that's what I'd want her to know.
Rachel, I love this. Thank you for making the time for us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
That was the founder and CEO of Hello7, Rachel Rogers. For more inspiring interviews with women like Rachel, head on over to secondlifepod.com, where we have so many more for you to peruse. If you like today's show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. We love seeing you spread the word on social. And now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. We always want to know who you're interested in hearing from on the show. So send in your request to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM us on Instagram. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.